and welcome to episode 16 of Checking the Gate, a film and religion podcast. I am Robert Wright Stasko.
And I am Michael M. Patty.
And today we're going to finally tackle the topic of the seminal movie Metropolis.
We've been putting this off for like 4 months now.
And also in the TV corner, we're going to bring back the TV corner after a long hiatus and talk about the similarly themed, ill-fated Caprica TV show.
No, it wasn't ill-fated. It got exactly what it deserved. Well, more on that later.
But hey, let's get right down to it. Metropolis. You know, why do a very old movie when a lot of the stuff we've done is very recent? Like Prometheus, we did a few weeks after it came out, and now we're doing a movie that's almost 90 years old. So why did we do this?
I have no idea. All I know is Superman never showed up. Well, no, the reason is because not only does it have religious symbolism, which is what we plan on discussing, it's also overall an influential film. It came out in 1927, directed by a German man named Fritz Lang, who was very ahead of his time in terms of the plot of this. Silent movies didn't have complicated plots about societal revolutions. They were about falling in love. There's a knockoff of Dracula called Nosferatu you might be familiar with that came out around the same time. They didn't have robots and revolution and giant buildings and flashbacks, and they didn't have any of that, and he really introduced a lot of that. It feels very modern. If you watch this film, it does not feel like it's 80-some years old. It's worth seeing just to see the influence it's had on modern cinema.
For example, in a recent issue of Entertainment Weekly, there's an interview with Christopher Nolan about the brand new movie Dark Knight Rises, which has been out maybe 24 hours as the time of this recording. And in this article, Nolan cites Metropolis as an influence for Gotham City, which is kind of funny when you think about it.
Shouldn't Metropolis be an influence for Man of Steel?
I guess we'll see when that one rolls around.
Yes.
But we've already done Superman. I don't think we're going to talk about Superman anymore.
We can always talk about Superman some more.
Other influences, definitely Blade Runner. If you look at some of the shots of the new Tower of Babel, is put right in Blade Runner. Is like the police building looks exactly like it.
Any of those dystopian movies that have dark, foreboding cities, this was the first. It all starts here.
Yeah, it's all glitz and glamour on top, and as you go deeper, it gets more depressing. You can definitely see that influence in Dark Knight Rises. Some other movies that have been influenced by this. And this list comes from a very good essay called From Metropolis to Metroprisu, The Changing Role of the Robot in Japanese and Western Cinema by Lee McKella, and a book called Japanese Visual Culture, which is very excellent. Good read. And this essay gives you a great rundown of both Fritz Lang's movie and the Japanese anime that was sort of based on it. But it says some of the movies to be influenced by Metropolis are Ghost in the Shell, a Japanese anime, Steven Spielberg's AI, Artificial Intelligence, Alex Proyas' iRobot, and obviously George Lucas' Star Wars series, because the robot in here was definitely a prototype for C-3PO, especially if you look at the early Ralph McQuarrie drawings.
Yeah, he definitely took that and colored it gold. And if you look at the early concept drawing for 3PO and R2, that's what 3PO looks like.
Well, Lucas, he ripped off everything.
Well, maybe not everything.
Yeah, well, he's solely to blame for Jar Jar.
All right, enough Jar Jar bashing. Interesting production note, that was actually her in the costume.
Yes.
I read up on that because I wanted to see, like, what else did they do after this movie? And she actually lived all the way to 1996.
Yeah, you're talking about the actress,
Brigitte Helm. Yes.
Who played Maria and
Evil Maria.
Yeah.
And the robot.
The robot.
That was her in the suit. She found it excruciating, but still believed in the vision enough to continue.
Yeah, same with Anthony Daniels. But
and the quote I read was, and I forget where I read it, so I apologize for the lack of attribution. She wanted to know why Fritz Lang didn't have a double put in there, and he said, "I wanted to know it was you. If it had been a double, I couldn't have seen you in there." There you have it.
In terms of the other production, especially like some of the visuals we see of the city,
yeah.
Of
they have a video phone in this movie.
Yeah. Way ahead of its time. Just the way they pulled off some of the effects was...
Yeah, like the lightning and the glowing rings that go around the robot. I have no idea how they would have done that in 1927.
Yeah.
I honestly don't.
And it still holds up.
Yeah.
You look at it and you're like, wow, she's really transforming. When you see the Tower of Babel and there's airplanes and cars going in front of it, that was a huge, like, miniature, I guess.
Oh, yeah.
The phrase now is bigature.
Yeah.
Because it was on the scale of the stuff that Peter Jackson did for Lord of the Rings. And each of those cars, they did stop motion.
Wow.
On the making of documentary that came with the DVD for The Complete Metropolis, they explain it took 8 days to shoot a few seconds of footage for that.
Wow.
So, and it was the John Carter of its day. All that, it cost almost 5 million Reichsmarks. And it only made like 75,000 Reichsmarks when it came out.
Wow.
Yeah.
Ouch. So
it was the early 20th century Waterworld.
Oh. Side note, I saw John Carter. It was not nearly as bad as all that.
I agree.
I saw, speaking of, you saw the DVD and the extras. I saw it over Netflix streaming in HD, and we watched the restored version, which puts back a lot of... Yeah, that's another thing, you know, movie note. A lot of the original director's cut was lost for years and years until, I want to say 2008, they found a nearly intact print of it in Argentina and were able to put back some of the footage. It doesn't look as good. It's in really bad shape, and it shows, but it's watchable, and you can, you know, follow the plot a little more easily. I think there was only one scene that they still didn't have where Maria escapes from the doctor.
Right.
Was the only scene where they had to explain what was going on. But all the rest of it was there, and it brings it up to 2.5 hours from under two, I think I read.
It was like an hour and a half they cut it down.
Yeah. Now, it is very long, and a modern-day editor probably could have done a decent job of it, but nevertheless, it's astonishing that after all these years that they could bring an influential movie back to the way the director originally meant it to be.
It's fabulous.
It looks great.
Yeah, and especially when you watch it and you see at the beginning, the mediator between the head and the hands must be the heart. And then they bring that to fruition at the end, especially with the new music that they recorded, the original musical score. I've never seen it with that original score, which helped them edit it back together properly because they followed the cues in the score to put the scenes in the proper place. To me, it's beautiful. It makes me emotional.
Robert's impressed by the music. I'm impressed by the picture quality.
Yeah, go figure. In terms of just the visuals in this movie, especially in the beginning when you see the Eternal Gardens, it's also called the Garden of the Suns, where all the rich kids frolic and play and chase girls around with peacocks and everything. That looks a lot like Hieronymus Bosch's famous painting, The Garden of Earthly Delights.
Which we will now spend the rest of the podcast describing for you.
No.
No. Google it, kids.
Yeah, it'll blow your mind, sort of like this movie. But yeah, that kind of starts the religious imagery in this movie. And then when we see Maria...
Were there any gardens in the Bible that were really nice?
Yeah, at the very beginning.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
I showed up late.
Yeah, well, maybe if you read it once in a while.
Guess we'll never know. I kid.
Before you said this is a modern movie, again, I'm going to commit the same sin of non-acknowledgement. There is a quote I heard read somewhere. I could not, for the life of me, find it. It said, this movie, as modern as it is, and as forward-looking, and as predictive and prophetic as it is, it's also a throwback, using a lot of medieval Christian imagery as Mike likes to say, sledgehammer its point home.
Very sledgehammery. Sometimes. I think it's all mixed together.
Yeah. Yeah, because you have Maria.
It's a stew of imagery.
Yeah, like Maria, who is definitely patterned after Mary, Mother of Jesus. The way she's dressed and the way her makeup and hair is done and the way she gestures and everything. It's very much like stereotypical images we have
and
of
I,
that
I,
icon.
I thought he was putting in a little Mary Magdalene with the main character, Frieder.
Yes.
We'll get around to explaining it in a little while, but she's the love interest for him. And so I think that's kind of played with a little bit, too, that she's teased like she could be Magdalene-ish.
Yeah.
Did you think so?
I think more of it comes out in the robot Maria. The evil deception that she pulls out.
I'm sorry, you know? I did not make that clear. Yes, that's what I meant.
Okay, yeah. It is confusing.
Because it's the same actress.
Yeah, and the characters are obviously confused as well, especially Frieder. That's why he freaks out in the middle. But maybe now would be a good time to kind of briefly summarize the movie.
All right, if we can briefly summarize the movie. In broad terms, what the movie is about is Metropolis is a bustling city where intellectuals and artists and scientists, all the high courtly people live. But it was built on the blood and sweat and toil of the underclass. And the head of the city is Joe Friederson, and his son is Frieder. Frieder decides to find out how the other half lives and meets Maria, who is showing little kids the garden that Robert mentioned, and she wants to show them how the better half lives. And they meet, and, you know, it's cute and aw. And
love at first sight.
Yeah. So he decides to go and find her and trades places with a worker down there. And in the meantime, his dad is trying to keep the workers from revolting, so he has an evil doctor who was in love with Joe's wife turn his robot creation into a clone of Maria to infiltrate the workers and bring them down. And it turns out Frieder has to become the mediator between the head and the hands.
That imagery is hammered home to us. First, when he switches places with the worker, he takes over this machine, and it kind of looks like a clock. It's not really clear what he's doing, but I went a little overboard with the research and read the book.
I did no research. That's not true.
But this book written by Fritz Lang's wife at the time, Thea von Harbo, she wrote the script and the book. And the movie really follows the book pretty closely. It varies in a few places. But here she describes the machine that Frieder is running. In the middle of the room crouched the Paternoster machine. It was like Ganesha, the god with the elephant's head. It shone with oil. It had gleaming limbs. Under the crouching body and the head, which was sunken on his chest, crooked legs rested, gnome-like, upon the platform. The trunk and the legs were motionless, but the short arms pushed and pushed alternately forwards, backwards, forwards. A little pointed light sparked upon the play of the delicate joints. The floor, which was stone, and the seamless trembled under the pushing of the little machine, which was smaller than a five-year-old sheaf. There's definitely the reference to the Hindu god there. It's not portrayed visually, but in the book, she describes this trunk of Ganesha coming down and sucking the life out of the workers and sucking their will and their hope. And it is a lot of this sort of imagery that runs all through the book. This is portrayed when Frieder sees an industrial accident. A bunch of workers are blown by all the steam pouring from the machine. They fly off of it, and he has a vision of Moloch, like people giving a human sacrifice and throwing people to the angry pagan god. So, yeah, that's the first sledgehammer there.
I'd like to bring in, since I did minimal research, not none, what was obvious to me was that the Christian allegory that Joe Friederson is the creator of Metropolis. He's the head of it. He's at the top of the tower. And the workers are the people of Earth. And Reader's the one who, the son of the creator, who has to go down there and be one of them and almost die.
Yeah.
But he does come back.
Yes.
And be the mediator between God and his people. I thought that was...
And he literally saves the children.
Yes.
From the flooding underground as the people, the stupid people... killed the heart machine and made all the underground fled.
And completely forgot about their kids.
Yeah. But here is also another religious reference to the Bible. When Maria tells the workers her version of the Tower of Babel story, you know, we have the new Tower of Babel, where mm-hmm. Joe Frieder lives. And she tells the story of how man had this idea to build a tower, but in the Bible, it's God who confuses people and they can't understand each other and they kind of disperse. In Maria's story, the people's language is not confused. She says, one man's hymn of praise becomes another man's curse. So the people who plan the building are singing praises and the people who are building the building are cursing. And she said there was no mediator between the head and the hands, and that's why the original tower was destroyed, because the workers pulled it down. So there's definitely a little Marxism going on here.
just a little. It was popular back then, what can we say?
Occupy Metropolis. Let's put that on a t-shirt. But yeah, the very subtle difference in the way she tells the story just really hammers the point home. And then probably the most spectacular scene is, I believe it's the intermezzo after Frieder has his breakdown and he's dreaming about what he sees at the cathedral.
The seven deadly sins.
Yeah, Death is playing his flute made of bone and the seven deadly sins follow him. And Frieder also dreams about Maria. She's introduced to everyone in the Yoshiwara Club. That is quite a striking visual, especially the one where, you know, when she first comes up out of the floor magnificently with all the lights shining behind her, and she starts to do her sultry dance. And
has no shirt on.
Yeah, she's got pasties on, which I didn't think they could get away with in 1927. But
apparently you could in Germany.
I guess this is some of the footage that was part of an early restoration. This was not part of like the American.
I don't think it was in a long time ago. I don't think it was in the version I saw in film school.
Yeah, definitely wasn't. She rises. She's riding a dragon. It's being held up by these strong,
swarthy young men.
Yes.
I believe is a good term for it.
And then Frieder, he sees the seven deadly sins sort of disappear. And the sins, the characters representing the seven deadly sins reappear underneath the dragon, and it becomes the beast, and she is the Whore of Babylon described in Revelation. So the book uses language right out of the book of Revelation to describe the evil robot Maria. Oh, I forgot to mention the Paternoster machine that looked like Ganesh. In the book, it's given that name. It's not given that in any of the title cards in the movie, I don't think. But it is Latin for our father, and that is hammered home in the book as well. So there's another interesting section that was in the book that wasn't in the movie. Frieder takes the place of a young man named Georgie, a worker, and his number is 11811. And Georgie takes Frieder's place, and he goes off to this Yoshiwara Club. And in the movie, he wanders out. Slim, the henchman of Joe Friederson, finds him and tracks down Frieder that way. But in the book, Slim goes into the club and finds Georgie. And everyone in the club has taken this drug called Mauhi. And it allows people to share emotion. They call it like they share the intoxication of others. And Georgie takes this drug and people sort of freak out and bow down and worship him because his hopelessness that he's felt all the years of doing this meaningless job working on this machine has sort of decimated everybody around him. He drives people to worship him the way he's worshipped this machine that's been his whole life. I don't know how they could have done that in a silent movie, but it is pretty striking in the book.
All right.
So that was interesting. But other than that, the book really follows pretty closely what happens in the movie. Especially, Frieder, you discussed how he was a lot like Jesus. I kind of see also how he's a lot like Buddha. Buddha was originally a prince who lived a life of luxury, and his father had sheltered him from everything else in the world, all the poverty that existed outside of his castle, until one day he made his way out in the balcony and saw the suffering of others. So he escaped and lived the ascetic life of the common person, but the austere life wasn't for him either, and he was a mediator as well. He found the middle way. So, and that's, you can see...
Yeah, fascinating.
How Frieder is like that, like Maldib, which we talked about in our Dune episode.
Oh, yes.
Dune
episode.
He was a conglomeration of several religious figures, and we see Frieder doing that the same way.
Would Long have known about, would he have put Buddhism in on purpose?
I don't know if he would have, but the scriptwriter, Teia von Harbo, definitely would have.
Okay.
Because she references a lot of Hindu gods, pagan gods, all throughout the book. Also, an interesting note, shortly after this movie was made, the Nazi Party rose in power in Germany. Fritz Lang fled the country and started making movies in Hollywood. And he had divorced his wife, who was a Nazi sympathizer. So,
Brigitte Helm and her husband fled the Nazis as well.
You know, we talked a little bit about how this movie influenced a lot of other movies, and we talked about Blade Runner, but you could really see, and here's our segue, how it influenced TV shows like Battlestar Galactica. You have a robot who looks like a really hot chick, but you don't know that she's a robot. You see how that works?
That was quite impressive.
This is going to lead us to our TV corner. Welcome to our TV corner. That segue didn't go as smooth as I was wanting it to.
No.
But we're going to talk about the show Caprica, where it gets to the, I don't know, the origins of the Cylon race.
Barely. In like the last three episodes it does.
Maybe like the last 10 minutes of the last episode.
Yeah. Ideally, and the way this show was pitched before it premiered, it was going to be about the creator of the robotic Cylons and his relationship with Commander Adama's father. And that was not entirely a lie. The truth is, week to week, the show was more about dirty company dealings, the mob, religious fundamentalism, and crooked police. And not nearly enough about the first Cylon.
Right.
There were weeks that I felt like, why did I just waste an hour of my life on this when nothing happened? And yeah. It lasted 19, probably four too many episodes.
Yeah. It really took a bad turn in the middle when they started doing the whole new Cap City thing.
None of that had anything to do with Battlestar Galactica stuff, other than it was futuristic, and the whole virtual reality thing wasn't seen on BSG at all. So it's like, what, did nobody bring one of these on board with them?
Yeah, they could have used a holodeck. Those poor soldiers.
Oh, let's be honest. You know what they would have done with that.
The relationship between Dr. Greystone and Adama was a good setup. And they just went the wrong way with it. And
absolutely.
In the TV show, they both lose their daughters in a terrorist attack, a bombing by this group, the Soldiers of the One, which is sort of a mixing of Christian, Muslim.
Yeah, they're the militant monotheists.
Yeah, and the polytheists, the pagans here who worship what we would call the Greek and Roman gods, they're the good guys. The monotheists are the weirdos. So the story starts out good, where
It starts out okay.
Where Dr. Greystone discovers his daughter, before she died, had made a virtual clone of herself. And he, like, downloads this and puts it into a robot body, which is the first Cylon. And then a bunch of other stuff that doesn't really matter happens. And at the very last episode, she downloads into a flesh and blood body. They figure this out in, like, the last 30 seconds of how to download and get their daughter back. And this is the first Cylon that looks like a person. So here we see how Dr. Rotvang from Metropolis, and, you know, trying to create a robot to replace his dead wife, Hel, is like Dr. Greystone trying
to... It's Joe Frederson's dead wife.
Yeah, well, they were both in love with the same woman.
Right, but so. it was Joe Frederson's wife.
Yes. Right. He's still... This is more clear in the book that Joe Frederson stole the woman from the mad scientist.
Yes, that was not clear.
Yeah, it's not clear in the movie, but it is definitely one of the motivations for the evil doctor, trying to create his long-lost love. And here in Caprica, we have Dr. Greystone trying to create his dead daughter.
And Adama also. Joseph. I think rather than harp on how much of a missed opportunity the show was, maybe we should just focus on the religious elements and get in and get out, shall we?
Yeah. This was not your favorite show, was it?
I don't miss it.
I was a little disappointed. I think if it had gone to a second season, they might have fulfilled the promise that
It would have been more corporate intrigue, more worrying about whether or not being a mob lawyer was bad. See, we're doing it. We're doing exactly what I just said we shouldn't do.
Well, I was kind of hoping that it would get more into the moral territory of when a person dies, should you move? And they touch on this a little bit with the way Adama kind of struggles with his losing his daughter. You know, shouldn't you just accept what has happened and move on? Because this was something that Rotwang and Joe Frederson could not do in Metropolis, and this is what Dr. Greystone and Adama could not do, and they had to bring people back. Incidentally, I'm catching up on Fringe, watching that on DVD, and that is also the sin of Dr. Walter Bishop. His son dies, and he uses his knowledge to kind of defeat nature and get his son back.
Yeah, but I guess couldn't it be argued that if you think you can, why not try?
Let's look at the consequences. In Metropolis, this led to a riot, the near destruction of the city, and the near death of an entire generation of workers, and nearly an overthrow of the people in charge.
No, that wasn't because he was trying to bring his wife back. That was political machinations that his crazy boss had him do. He made her do that. That wasn't a result of his experimentation.
It depends on which cut of the movie you're watching. I get that from the complete cut. Maybe if you're watching the American version, it's more like, you know, the boss telling his underlings what to do. But then let's look at Fringe. Dr. Walter Bishop's efforts to get his son back led to a crack between universes and the near destruction of both.
All right, I'll give you that one.
And Dr. Greystone, by inventing the Unit 182, which is the first Cylon, ushered in the entire destruction of the 12 colonies and the near extinction of the human race.
Yeah, but that was decades later.
Yeah, but it's the flap of the butterfly's wings, man. It created a storm.
Their intentions were good. And keep in mind, we're talking about fiction here.
Yeah.
I think that obviously he didn't, but he was building robot warriors, wasn't he?
Yes.
And I guess putting his daughter's consciousness inside one probably wasn't the best idea. He probably could have built her own non-armed robot.
Yes.
In hindsight.
You don't want to give a bitter teenager combat skills.
I learned that lesson the hard way.
Yeah. Don't teach your teenagers how to take apart.
Oh my god, that's a great idea for a
movie. Put it back together.
Combat Kid.
Oh no.
It's like Chuck meets it's like Chuck and Rambo had a kid.
Yes, science run amok.
starring one of the kids from Glee. All right, should we talk about the Soldiers of the One?
Yeah, because this is like the main religious element, and I was never quite sure what kind of statement they were trying to make with the Soldiers of the One.
I think that was their point. I think it was deliberately, I don't want to say ambiguous, but deliberately off-putting that they wanted you to not know what to think about them. Because they're sympathetic terrorists, and they are terrorists.
Yeah.
James Marsters was the head terrorist. He was good on the show. They had Zoe's friend, who is in every other episode, and she becomes sort of a main character. She gets drafted by the Soldiers of the One, and the headmistress of her school is... She's not the leader, but she's a section head.
Yeah.
And she is recruiting all these kids from this school to be her
own personal army.
Right. And she's trying to overthrow James Marsters. And I think at the end of this, she does end up getting him killed, doesn't she?
Yeah.
And there's an episode, like one of the last ones, where they're at a training camp for these people, and she's starting to question whether or not terrorism is actually part of the One God's rule.
Yeah,
I don't remember how that turns out.
The girl's name is Lacey Rand. I'm looking this on IMDb.
That is correct.
And her teacher, Clarice Willow, the section head, she sends her off to terrorist training school. And I think it also, like in the last montage of the last episode, you see her become the mother superior of the terrorist group, because somehow the robot gets there, and they make more of these robots, and they all listen to her. So Lacey controls the Cylons, and
I guess we can assume that Zoe and Lacey meet up again after Zoe has a new body, and they both become monotheists, and eventually that's how the Cylons become monotheists.
Yeah, and that's how they start the Cylon War.
Yeah.
We were supposed to find this out in the aborted Blood and Chrome. I keep hearing about it, and I think it was going to be a web series. But did you ever see that? Did that ever come out?
There was a 90-second trailer for it, and all I heard was Sci-Fi decided not to make it a full-blooded series, and that eventually the 90-minute, well, two-hour movie might air at some point. All I can think was, if Sci-Fi is not showing a Battlestar Galactica product, the other 88 and a half minutes that weren't shown in the trailer
must be really bad.
Must really be bad.
Just the whole setup didn't look good to me. It's like Adama as a young man.
Yeah, it's another prequel series, and we don't need that.
I guess I wanted to put the action back into it because he's got an old crotchety commander who gives him a hard time or something, and it just looked like more wheel spinning. It's like, ooh, we had this really successful series. Let's see if we can get more money out of it.
Yeah.
So
on the one hand, I'm sorry they didn't go ahead with it, but on the other, I know what it would have been like, and we're probably better off.
What I would have liked to have seen is a whole series that was on the old Earth. Maybe that started out there, where the final five Cylons.
Yeah, that would have been
how they come and find this war going on, and how they help the Cylons create the, what, nine models all together, the other...
Joshua?
Yeah. And how we see all that take place. That's what they should have done.
That would have been it. Instead of the plan, they should have had that be like a mini-series to...
Yeah. But I thought that's where Caprica was going to go, that it would lead up to that.
No,
like halfway through the show, we'd see these final five come in.
I'm certain Caprica was never going to show the final five.
That would have been cool. But again, we'll never know.
It ended strong. I'll give them that. I like how they wrapped it up with the montage that they did.
Yeah, you could probably...
The last episode was okay, but they had to cram all the stuff they were putting off for season two. They had to put it into the last episode. Maybe if you hadn't spread yourself too thin, you'd still be on the air.
I think that if you watch the first episode and the last episode, that's all you need to do.
Probably. Yeah. Oh, and get this. They kill little Bill Adama. And it turns out he's not even really the kid who grows up to be Commander Adama. I knew something was fishy with the dates, because I knew Adama couldn't be almost 70 in Battlestar Galactica.
Yeah.
That didn't make sense. That was a cheat.
So yeah, so Adama has another kid with the doctor from Stargate SG-1. And
she was like another lawyer. She was a character on this show. She was not a doctor from SG-1.
But that's how...
I don't know who
all,
she is.
All these sci-fi shows are kind of married together. But yeah, and they have the real William Adama that from the Battlestar Galactica that we really love. And that's how that works out. So, yeah. Unfulfilled promises. That's all we get. So, final thoughts on Metropolis.
Really good, really well-made film. Its ramifications are still being felt in the industry today. Seek out the restored version in high definition if you can and marvel at how good it looks after 85 years. Yeah, that sounds right.
Yeah.
And enjoy.
Yeah, well, and I would say watch it in surround sound if you can. Gorgeous soundtrack. Oh, just it was newly recorded just a few years ago. It is spectacular, and it really packs an emotional punch and underlines everything that is happening in this fantastic movie.
I watched it on mute because it was a silent movie. No, I didn't.
Oh, you pain. Oh, that hurts. Oh, that hurts. Okay, final thoughts on Caprica.
Good riddance.
That's all Mike has to say. I thought it could have said a lot about society, religion, what it means to play with nature and defy the laws of God and try and defeat death on your own terms and how bad it is and the repercussions. But
it didn't. It was just a soap opera.
Yeah, they just skipped right over that. They kind of touched on it a bit, sort of made it a generic religious fundamentalist and not to really say anything about fundamentalism or terrorism or how they link, but just to keep the plot going.
And they did a horrible job of keeping the plot going.
Yeah. It stalled out so many times. So, and that's all we have to say about that. Amen.
Okay.
For next time, we have a special treat because I know Mike's going to like this.
Uh-oh.
I have on the schedule.
I don't know what's coming right now.
You're going to like it.
Okay.
I changed the schedule up a little bit because this movie is also an older movie, but it has been rebooted recently and remade semi-recently. It is Planet of the Apes.
Oh.
Planet of the Apes.
Yes.
Because it has a lot to say politically.
Now, you're talking about the new one with James Franco, right?
I'm talking about all of them, really.
Oh, okay.
But I think mainly if we stick to, like, the original.
No, the original's the only one that warrants any kind of film discussion. The rest are all cash grabs.
Yeah.
Let's not lie.
We'll touch on some of them.
Okay. But like the second one, maybe, too, because the bomb.
Yeah. Also, the remake by Tim Burton.
Do we have to?
You don't have to watch it, Mike,
okay.
But if you remember generally what happens, we'll touch on it. And maybe the recent reboot, but I don't think that didn't have a whole lot.
That had mostly callbacks to the original.
Yeah.
More than religious.
Yeah, that's more socially minded than religious minded. But
right.
Definitely, I mean, who doesn't love the original?
Oh, my wife.
Well, she doesn't have to watch it.
Okay. I may try and get her to, though.
Shh, don't tell her. We'll do that for next time. Also, we'll do another change-up. Let's, instead of TV Corner, we'll do a Book Corner.
Sounds good.
Kind of a TV Corner. It's a good segue. The Stand. We'll talk about The Stand.
They recorded a new audiobook that just came out in February of this year. I have listened to it, and I will share my thoughts on the book, and since there is a mini-series, we'll probably mention that.
Yes, we're talking about The Stand, written by Stephen King, available on many different formats, audiobook, ebook, regular book.
Big, thick, dead tree.
If you want to talk to us about anything that you've heard us say, if you disagree with us, if you agree with us or not.
If you think this show is too long.
Let us know. You can leave a comment on our website, www.ctgpodcast.com. Send us an email at ctgpodcast@yahoo.com. You can Twitter us at twitter.com/CTG podcast or Facebook us at facebook.com/CTG podcast.
Sounds good. Facebook is probably the, we can both see that if you put it on Facebook.
Yes, definitely do that. All right. So until then, this is Robert saying keep the faith.
And this is Mike saying peace out.